Today's episode of A Waste of Time with It's the Real is sponsored by the good people at Martell Cognac, the oldest of the four great cognac houses established well over 300 years ago.
When the night's young, who you ring is a tough choice. But when it comes to what to order at the bar, there's only one call.
Martell. Martell.
Martell VS Single Distillery is a cognac of exceptional richness and vivid fruit aromas, crafted from one source, which leads to a richer taste and an intensely flavorful cognac. Perfect for when your baby picks up, or those times when she's definitely just on a conference call for work and everything is just fine.
Martell
Blue Swift is the first ever VSOP cognac finished in Kentucky bourbon barrels. It combines Martell's signature style of delicate fruit and plum notes, now complemented by the subtle sweetness of vanilla and toasted oak from the bourbon casks. Blue Swift is always on time, and honestly, the ringer must have shifted in the pocket, because it shouldn't have been on silent. Thank you to the Martellophone Man for supporting It's the Real. If you support us, and you want to see this podcast flourish, go support the good people at Martell Cognac.
Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Eric.
How are you?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
Doing well, thank you. As our loyal listeners know, we've been traveling a bunch lately. We've been to Los Angeles. We've been to Atlanta, to New Orleans. We went to Austin, Texas,
yep.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Northeast Ohio.
There's probably a Jersey trip in there.
But one trip that we have not talked about is the trip around the bases.
Woo!
At Citi Field, home to your first place, New York Mets.
Home run.
Shouts to our friends over at New Balance who invited us over to Citi Field. You know what was interesting about that day?
What's that, Eric?
Was that it snowed. It snowed in the spring.
Yeah.
And we were not able to take part in the home run derby that we were promised. And by the way, we're not exactly sure how it would have been handled in the first place, because none of us, not Ravy B, not Cam from Deuce Palooza, not Joe LaPuma from Complex, not us, none of us are going to hit, you know, some bombs down the left field line.
Speak for yourself. I've been doing a lot of HGH.
Oh, is that right?
A lot of, horse.
Oh, for basketball?
Yeah, I've been playing.
Horse tranquilizers. Yeah,
no,
yeah, yeah.
I was thinking of heroin.
So we went there, and their rainy day and really snowy day plan was to just go into the batting cages and take our hacks in there.
Yeah, get some frozen ropes.
That's right. And listen, the whole event was amazing. Like, you walk in there and they have these giant baseball cards with our faces on them. They have custom headphones for us from Beats by Dre, and they have uniforms for us. And we did get asked a few weeks earlier to send our picks for our walk-on music.
Well, I was going to do Nelly's Batter Up.
Which, you know, on the nose.
Yeah, well, I wanted the welcome, ladies and gentlemen.
Right, just on the loudspeakers outside.
It would have sounded so good. But then I was like, it's a little bit like, I don't know, hacky. And so I was like, all right, what if I was to do Return of the Mac,
right,
by French Montana?
Ah.
Because it is a New York homecoming for me.
So that's a really good one.
Yeah.
Did they get it right?
They did get it right. They played.
I would have thought that they would have gotten that wrong. I thought they would have played, you know, Mark Morrison's version, which, by the way, is great.
Yeah, but not the superior version.
But it's
the
not
superior
French,
version
right.
would be French Montana. And as you know, this is a household that reveres French Montana.
Totally. Well, not today, though. Not on this podcast.
Oh, right. Yeah, no.
Shout out to Jim Jones. But.
Yeah.
But they got it right. They got your song right. I, as everyone knows, love 2 Chainz' verse on Champions.
Right, by Kanye West.
Or the Good Music, you know, family, right?
Yeah, the Good Music cartel.
And I went in there just pumped to hear the song, and they played, instead of Champions,
they played
Champion.
Do you realize, doo-doo, you were a champion in this?
Which, I mean, great song.
Bam, bam, bam. Yes, I did.
But it's just a little light walking into the batting cage.
Not the song you want to hear.
Well, it didn't affect, you know, my stroke. I got I got 18 hits. You got 20 something.
I came in third place,
which is great. Behind yeah.
Well, me and Joe LaPuma tied.
Nice. Shout out to you and Joe.
Yeah.
Russ Bankston beat you out.
Yep.
And then I think
the professional lacrosse player.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Paul.
Paul not gonna work here anymore.
Well, shout out to him anyway. Nice
yeah.
guy.
Yeah.
The other thing about that day is that we left with a ton of stuff. Like I said, the headphones and the uniforms and the gloves and all that.
Yeah.
With engraved bats.
Yeah, we both have bats in our house.
Like real, legitimate baseball bats well, with our names.
Which is a great thing because, as you know, we have not been guys who lock the top lock on our door.
So,
only DJ Premier does. So, and so failing DJ Premier hanging out in our apartment, two bats. So if you're trying to break in our place,
yeah, you want to come in here and you want to bring your mixtape, just know
I'm gonna, you know,
you're gonna leave with your name, with Jeff's name on your forehead.
Yeah, I'm gonna get some real Julio Franco cuts in.
There you go.
Some Ray Ordonez choppers down the your kneecap.
Oh, Jeff, today on the podcast.
Today on the podcast, we have our great friend Jim Jones, the cult leader.
There you go.
From
Well, this is Joseph Guillermo Jones, right?
Guillermo Joseph Jones. Joseph Guillermo Jones.
Well, whatever. Jimmy Jones.
Jim Jones.
Jim
not
Jones.
Not the cult leader.
Dipset, Diplomats, Eastside.
Vamp Life.
Harlem representer. Jim Jones finally came up here to the apartments. He came to South Harlem to have a dope conversation. And man, he lived up to our expectations.
Yeah, we talked about everything from, you know, him growing up in Harlem and moving around the East Side.
Going to the Skate Key, going to Jersey, to different clubs, going to the Tunnel.
We asked him if he had ever thrown up the Rock.
Yeah, listen, stay tuned for that. We also talked about his time, and not a lot of people know this, the time that he worked over at
Warner Music Group.
Warner Music Group as the director of A&R. We talked about the first time we met Jim Jones, which is a crazy story. And we talked about just a whole lot of stuff with Cam, with Zeke, with Jewels,
T.I.
And all the Rockefeller stuff. First time meeting Jay-Z and Biggs and all this stuff. So for everybody who wanted this Jim Jones episode to drop immediately.
Oh, that's me.
We think it's worth the wait. So
here it is.
Here it is.
Stop waiting.
Jim Jones, it's the real. Jeff, when do you want to get into it?
Right after people leave a comment
and
subscribe on iTunes. Let's get our iTunes numbers up. Why not?
Why not? Or else, there's a bat with Jeff's name on it.
Jeff Guillermo Rosenthal.
Jeff, when do you want to get into it?
Right now.
Yo, what up? It's Eric, a.k.a. Traffic Jam, a.k.a. Moving Weight. Yo, what up? It's Jeff, a.k.a. Fix Your Face, a.k.a. Feng Shui Lee.
Cody Jones, a.k.a. Cavill Stairs.
Yeah, and this is Waste Time, but it's the real. Jimmy, what's happening?
I'm good. How y'all feel?
We're good. Yo, congratulations on this project. First and foremost, Wasted Talent.
I appreciate that.
The teaser video that you put out is you and Cam playing basketball, and you walked in here with a basketball injury, so.
Oh, yeah. I was trying to play a celebrity game, man.
Yeah, how'd that work out?
It didn't work out too good.
So what's up? Are we rocking a sling for the whole summer then?
I can move my arm now. I just try to keep it in a sling as much as possible for the next couple of weeks, so I can heal up right and not really, you know what I mean? So it's cool.
Well, all right, then when are we getting you back out there on the court?
I don't think I'm going to play. I want to get back in the gym, though. That's my passion. I love being in the gym, but with this little injury, all I could do is legs and core and shit like that, so, you know. All
right, so last summer, we put together this celebration of Rockefeller Records, and we brought together all on one stage Biggs and Hip Hop and Lenny S. and
Young Guru, Just Blaze,
Chaka Pilgrim,
Young Guns, Freeway.
And we wanted to make sure that we placed that call to Harlem.
Yeah.
And, well, let's just play a clip from that show from Highline Ballroom.
Jim, real quick, who's the more surprising guest up here, me or you?
That was a good one. You got me.
Jim, can you also talk about what you remember about Oh Boy?
Oh Boy, the record?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we were supposed to have that record.
Nah.
We
I mean, it was like a compilation, more or less.
Yeah, can we squash this once and forever?
Can we just tell the real actual story?
Yeah.
We could tell an accurate story.
Yeah. I remember what happened.
I want to hear from Justin.
I remember what happened.
I want to hear from him. That's what I want to hear.
Okay. So I made the beat on an SP-1200, first of all. The SP-1200 that I think you might have in your house.
Man, technical out of nowhere.
Sorry for the technical.
Can I to the story.
He's a tech. He's a
to
techie
the story,
guy.
Baby.
Sorry.
All that 1200 Pro Tools. All right, we passed that part.
SP-930.
That was 20 minutes. We gave him 20 minutes of that. Something else. Come on.
I can do this or I can leave right now.
One button.
Oh, shit.
I'm gonna turn this mic off.
Nah, for real. Can I?
You want
make
me to tell?
I'm gonna make it 2 seconds.
You can't make it two seconds because you weren't there.
Nah, I'm telling you.
Nah, he was there.
He was there. This is annoying.
He was there. Go ahead.
The fact of the matter is, I made the beat on the SP. Bleak said no. That sounds like love song music.
Yes. Played it for Bleak.
I made it again.
He
turned out a lot of heat. FYI.
Yes.
He definitely did.
I gave him whoa.
He wasn't there.
Right.
He definitely turned out whoa.
Bleak turned out a lot of heat. Okay, I gave him Uchiwali, right?
I didn't know that one.
Definitely gave him Uchiwali.
He played Old Boy to Bleak first, and Bleak.
Hold on. But Bleak is my nigga. We're not going to shit on Bleak.
No, all due respect. All due respect, it wasn't the same beat. It was a very fast one, and I was like, oh, yeah, maybe I fucked up. So I went and made it again. Played it for Jay. This was before we do Blueprint. Jay said, yeah, that's dope. Hold it for me. I held it for him. Nothing happens. He wasn't recording. So then about a year later, 8 months later, I play it for him again. He's like, yo, that shit is cool, but I'm about to do this Pharrell record real quick. So I'm like, all right, cool. It is what it is. Then you call me hit while I'm at home.
Mm-hmm.
Yo, I just gave you. Remember, you used to have the infamous.
Yeah. I had
CD book.
The CD book. That's what happened. Because I remember they came early one morning, and they was mad at me, and they was like, yo, Hip, you never give us shit. You know what I'm saying? And
yeah, we had vengeance in us.
And you know what I mean? And we go way back. So I felt like, you know what I mean? I was like, yo, I got some shit here. And I remember putting the CD in, and then I remember Cam just going, like, okay, let's do that. Go get Guru. You know
right.
what I'm saying?
But then you call
me. Woke Guru.
You call me. And then Guru called me and said, yo, they rapping to the old boy. They're about to rap to the old boy.
It said old boy on the CD.
Right.
On the joint.
Right.
When
but
we
can
had
I dispel all this shit about, like, niggas was on some bullshit. It was never nothing like
that.
The nigga Cam came in the studio. He was like, yo, Guru, he still ain't rap on that beat? Yo, put that beat up. I'm about to destroy this shit.
Yeah.
That's all Cam said to me. He was like, yo, he still ain't. It's like a year later.
Yep.
He was like, yo, put the beat up.
We got to have that.
Him, and at the time, it's like Juel just went ham on the joint. You know what I'm saying?
Because
it stopped on the first version of where he says Guru start popping them.
Yeah,
I remember Cam was like, yo, Guru, we're not even playing with this. Put a rough mix on it. And he ran to the radio station, and he pressed enough, and enough played the record, and Dame came to the studio. He was like, yo, we shooting a video to that Friday.
But before that, in the office,
welcome to Rockefeller Records.
Yeah,
I was there.
Yeah, I mean, well, when we all signed to Rockefeller at the time, it was started off as a tight-knit group, and, you know, there was a little bit of a separation. But all in all, everybody has their own relationships and rapport with each other. So, you know.
Let's take it back to the very beginning. Tell us what it was like growing up in East Harlem.
Growing up on the east side of Harlem. East side is cool, man. You got to see a lot of dope hustlers coming up. A lot of great basketball players. East side was fast-paced. They called it El Barrio. A lot of Spanish people.
Big family?
Big family? Me? Yeah, I have a big family, but we all didn't live on the east side. At that time, I was living with my cousin David and my aunt Viola on the east side. I lived with a lot of different family members coming up when I was younger, and the east side was just one of my destinations. So, but the east side was fun as hell. You know, R.I.P. Bloodshed, he was an east side legend. Cam used to come back and forth over there when he would stay with his grandmother from the west side and shit like that. And he would come and bust niggas' ass in basketball. And, they were always rapping, and they were definitely talented. And, you know, we just were teenagers doing what teenagers do, trying to get new sneakers, trying to get somebody to get us some liquor out the liquor store, pooling our money together to get weed, going to grown ass parties way too early. yeah, that was us. We thought we was grown at the age of 14 or 15. We definitely started to attend some of the most premier events at such a young age. But I guess that's a Harlem thing. Goes both for guys and girls. That's a, you know, that got fooled by the cool crowd.
Well, growing up, like, what events are you going to? Like, what?
Oh, back in the day,
yeah. You're probably not clubbing yet, but what parties are uptown? What are the places that you're hanging out at?
Well, uptown had their own little couple parties and stuff like that. Like, you know, when we were younger, we first would go uptown. Like, Building 480s would have parties. Menacing would have parties. There was a church that had some parties. That was it. Then, you know, when you hit the cusp of 15 to 16, you kind of stepped it up. You probably go to the Skate Key. Skate Key up on Allenton.
Were you nice at skating, though?
Was I nice at skating? Yeah. I know how to skate. I don't think I was the nicest at skating. I wasn't really going to Skate Key to skate. Sometimes, yeah. Sometimes you skate, you have some fun, but most of the time you was going up there to see the girls. You know, all the high school kids, all the cool high school kids was there, the older kids. And then after that, the next step was full-blown clubbing. We would go to Skate Key in Jersey. You know, Jersey clubs closed early, like 2, then we would rush back to the rink of Allenton because they closed like 3. And then
wait, which one of you had a car, though?
We would put cabs on hold back in the day. Very few had cars. Like, my uncles and them used to hustle, so they had the Lexus 4-door and all that back in the day. I would get in with them. But like Cam and God bless Huddy, they would put cabs on hold. That was the infamous thing to do when you was younger and you was hustling and got a couple dollars. Call a Harlem cab base. Yo, let me get 9-3 on hold. Tell them I want them on hold. Going on hold. It was like $30 an hour back then for a cab to put a cab on hold. Keep a cab on hold for 10 hours. Just riding around smoking man weed. You had Branson weed. You had 56th Street had some of the good weed. Like, it was just a lot of different places we would go. Harlem was his own little world, man. It just was. And then, you know, from the east side, I went back to the Bronx. And then from the Bronx, I came back and then ended up on the west side. And then the west side was a whole different ball game. It was way different from the east side.
So last year, you did this epic interview with Funkmaster Flex.
So good.
In which you said that early on, you figured out that you were the enforcer of the crew. When did you figure out that that was your lane in life?
In life, I just was always a protector of myself. I wouldn't take no shit. I started young with me and Zeke. Zeke was kind of my enforcer when I was younger. He was always a little bit more bigger than most of the kids, had a lot of size on them, and we was loose. He went to from summer school or elementary school to high school and Catholic school. You know what I mean? And me and Zeke done did it all. Very aggressive, always fighting, you know, drinking 40s before school, getting in trouble with Catholic school. Robbing the Catholic school store, buying sneakers with the money, selling candy, stealing candy out the store, selling to the school. He was just doing all type of shit to get fresh. Just so on the weekend we could go to whatever club we was going to or wherever we was meeting at. Like, we did a lot of shit at a young age, more than that, than grown-ups did all their life from, I would say, from the age of... I would even say just the whole high school career was just a little bit edgy. We just was going for it. Like, you know what I mean? Like, coming in, staying outside 5-6 in the morning, just running through the streets of Harlem. It just was natural. I mean, we stayed outside more than we stayed inside.
Did you feel creative in high school?
Yeah, hella creative. We was always creative. Oh, we always had that pizzazz. Like, I kind of always was the leader of the bunch per se and shit like that. Like, you know, I led with fashion. I always got fly my own different way, but just not like buying everything everybody else had, because I didn't have it all the time to buy what everybody else had, but I knew how to put shit together, and I come out looking fly that most niggas wouldn't had all the fresh shit that the girls thought was fly.
Yeah, but so, how'd that work with Catholic schools having uniforms?
Yeah, but me and Zeke found the way to swag it out. We would say we sprained our ankle damn near 5 times a month. Every time we got new sneakers, we would say we sprained the ankle, because they would let you wear a sneaker to school, one sneaker, one shoe. So when the Jordans would come out, all of a sudden, both of us had a sprained ankle. We limping in with the Jordans, like, Yeah, nigga, you know what's going on. We got him though, nigga. You got the other sneaker in your book bag. Like, nah, we was just terrible in Catholic school. We was in Catholic school when Fresh Prince of Bel-Air was popping, so we kind of was Will Smith in our high school, but a little bit more aggressive and shit like that. We was wearing the Blazers inside out. We was dragging, had the whole school dragging a book bag by one handle. Like, nobody was wearing a book bag. They just dragging us just along. For the principal called us to the office, told us stop dragging the book bags. Got the whole school following y'all. Like, now, me and Zeke was bad. We used to rob kids for their tuition, all type of shit. Play fight, go in your pocket, take your tuition. You don't even know you got robbed. Me and Zeke was terrible. Blank checks, check fraud. Take a $500 check, go get a notebook at the school office. They had to give you change. You'd take the change, go buy sneakers with it, $495. We just was wilding, bro. We was going for it, man, when we was younger, man. But it was the law where we was from. We came outside and we wanted to be like the older dudes that we saw. We thought they was doing it. They always had the new sneakers. Some of them had some cars, always had jewelry, the fly bitches. They looked cool when they were smoking their weed and drinking their liquor and shit like that.
On your block?
Yeah, on my block. On every block in Harlem. There wasn't no block different in Harlem. This is what you saw. This is what the epitome of being in Harlem was. This was the end all be all. I got to be like that. And we thought that's what it was. Coming up in the early 90s and shit like that, when we started to become young men and able to fend for ourselves and shit like that, you know, the direction that we went was in that direction of a hustler's direction, you know what I mean? Like, some of us are talented, Cameron and were talented to play basketball and at an early age had a way out, but, you know, due to the law of the streets, they wasted that talent. Just like the album. That's what it means. Not necessarily a bad thing, but there's a lot of things that we went through in life where we wasted our talent on, and we could have kind of flourished at that. But the law of the streets held a lot of us back. We just fortunate enough to use our street appeal to be able to get in the music game and show them everything that we did in Harlem. We got paid for it. We didn't live no different or do nothing different when we got into the game. We just gave them Harlem on 10. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm.
But what did you want to be when you grew up?
I still got some shit for like 25 years in my wallet. I had a couple things I wanted to be. I was so fly. I always thought I wanted to be a model, into some type of fashion. There was a couple things I wanted to be, but I kind of did all the things I wanted to be by being in the music industry.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. A lot of the stuff had to do with entertainment and fashion and just being somebody that everybody loved and adored. Like, you know, I used to say, I'm not famous, but all the famous people know me. That was my slogan when I was younger and shit like that. It meant a lot to me. Yeah.
How sure were you that you were definitely going to graduate high school?
That's how my household was built. It wasn't no getting around. I finished high school in my household. My grandmother and my uncles and my family, they was heavy on education and academics. Like, they were so heavy on it that it kind of prevented me from playing sports. Not that I wasn't good, I was dead nice in playing basketball, but
attendance,
they didn't want me to be playing on the team because they felt playing basketball would take away from my academic spirit. So that led to me just being in the street after school every day instead of being at basketball practice or being at track practice or being at, you know what I mean?
And yeah,
I was a little bit small, so homework and none of that shit was never a problem. Like, me and Zeke maintained straight A's and honor rolls and all type of shit when we was coming through high school, just off cheating and doing whatever. Like, you know, you got good grades in our households, both alike, you got what you want. Zeke grew up a little bit more different than I did. His pops was like a heart surgeon, his mom was one of the top nurses at the hospital, so his lifestyle was iller, and the shit that he was doing under the roof that he was living didn't make sense. Like, damn, he's just crazy and shit like that. You know what I mean?
When'd you and Cam first meet?
Me and Cam first met on the east side. I guess we were about 13. I remember they was like, see, we were stuck in our own bubble on the east side. We didn't know too much about the west side. So the older kids that did play ball and was in high school, and you get to meet different people and shit like that. Like, basketball was a big thing in Harlem, especially on the west side. But on the east side, we kind of was like out the bubble a little bit, even though we had other shit going on that we were known for. So when he got to the east side, we had a recreation center in 1199. 1199 is kind of like a bougie projects in the middle of Harlem. It was four buildings. They was co-ops. It was 32 floors, high rises. Most of the kids, their families was doing pretty good and shit like that. So
Duke the guys are from over there?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. People thought that we were a little bit snooty. Thought that we were pushovers. So the kids from the projects would come over. We always had to fight and kick ass to show that we wasn't no joke and shit like that. I just lost where I was
at. You and Cam.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, we're coming up on the east side. This going to 1199 Recreation Center and shit like that, and you hear people whispering, yo, that kid Cam just moved over here. That kid Cam, yo, he dumb nice, man. He one of the nicest kids in Harlem at it for his age. And it was just like a basketball conversation and shit like that. So when we was the young kids from the Recreation Center. Like, I had a cousin named Dave that was tremendously nice. Like, he should have went to the NBA. And I wouldn't say he wasted the talent. He didn't have the opportunities that a lot of these basketball players, like opportunities like Cam had, as Cam was so infused in the basketball community through the west side of shit. We just was on the east side. So my cousin Dave was just like retardedly nice for just like, it was almost like a gift from God that gave him. And Cam came over and I was like, man, you can't fuck with my cousin Dave. You can't fuck with my cousin Dave. And lo and behold, our first time was the Recreation Center and it was on the basketball court. And it was me and my cousin Dave on one team, and Cam was on another team. And the nigga was nice, like they said. But my cousin was nice, like I said. And that built to a competitive relationship between me and Cam from the start, even to now and shit like that, even with getting fresh and girls and shit like that. Whatever it was, it just, we had this thing, we'd come outside and call each other bum-ass niggas all the time. Like, you a bum-ass nigga. I seen you with the outfit on yesterday. You fucking bum, you disgrace me. That's how we would talk to each other and shit like that. And every time we was fresh, we'd make sure we made each other see each other. Like, nigga, you see how I run out, nigga. I'm getting money, nigga. Fuck you talking about. Just regular Harlem shit. That's Harlem banter, nigga. Harlem banter is about who getting money, nigga, and how fresh you is. Trying to get some ass. And, well, you know what I mean? Just regular kids, man. Just coming up.
Who were the big people in Harlem when you were coming up?
As far as what?
As far as the music scene or people who were flashy, people you saw on the street, like, who were the major figures?
In my project, it was a guy named Big Dave. God bless the dead. He passed away. He was probably the richest person to come out of my project. Millionaire. LL Cool J used his Benz on one of the covers, albums and shit like that. Mm-hmm. Like, that's in my hood. And coming up hustling, and we came up under a dude named Dita in our projects. After Big Dave, Dita used to work with Big Dave, and Dita probably was the richest nigga coming out of our projects. And then, you know, our projects was a dust projects. It was a lot of different niggas getting money. You had niggas uptown like my man O and shit like that. I don't even want to say his full name right now because I don't even know if he's still getting busy. But it was a guy named O, shit like that. My one of my dude's brothers, he had the navy blue 600 V12s back in like 91 and shit like that, and we used to go crazy when we see him. And you know, my block, you had No Fear, that was Jim Ice and all of them and shit like that. You had Fritz up the block, that's all my neighborhood on 12th Street and shit like that. These all the niggas that was getting some real major money. You had Fat Pop in my hood, they used to come to the Kingdom games all flashy and shit like that. Then after the watching the era, we started getting money, and our man Light probably was getting the most money in Harlem besides Baby Maine and shit like that. Like, they kind of was battling, these gentlemen making $50,000-$60,000 a day and shit like that. That shit is unheard of. I'm talking about for two summers straight and shit like that. Like, you know, these are just cash hand over fist and shit like that. And just the whole era of the homies and everybody I watched growing up, it just was a fast pace. I seen a lot of money get made, a lot of niggas get locked up, a lot of niggas get killed in a short span, like, in a matter of years. It's all before the year 2000. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
After the year 2000 is part of when we took music and life more serious, because we had lost the deal at that time, and the next thing was to give a
right, but before the Rock deal, before Cam's deal with UN, did you guys battle, like, outside Mart 125?
No, Cam, I mean, Cam and them would do their little battles every now and then, but it was that whole rap battle scene wasn't like it is today and shit like that. It was more ciphers and shit like that. Mm-hmm. People get on niggas' blocks and Cam would go roast a nigga. Cam was dead nice. Like, him and Mace was nice. coming up and Bloodshed and shit like
that. Yeah, but when did you realize that they were the nicest? Worst.
Right, when was the first time you heard?
Like, we grew up, they went from playing basketball. Cam and them was doing music since earlier. From when he moved over to the East Side, he was already doing music and shit like that. And it's because of Bloodshed lived and D-Building and shit like that. And then Blood started getting into the rap. And then, you know, Digga, they was all doing the CLC thing. And then when he came off the East Side, that's when I met them. And I got in tune with them doing the music and became an advocate for what they was doing and a representative of everything that was going on from there on then and shit like that. But them niggas was talented, like, talented. Like, the biggest break is when they started to do the Clue tapes and all the mixtapes and shit like that. That's around the same time Lox was doing mixtapes and shit like that. I can say that's like 94. Going through the year 95 is when they start really making their claim in music and shit like that. And we start going to the tunnel. We were like 16, 17. We all in the tunnel. 18. It's like, you know what I mean? Like,
what was the most amount of people that you brought to the tunnel?
Probably like 100.
Yeah, like maybe like, I would like to say like 100. I would get this some nights and then Mark be like, "Are you killing?"
You know,
and he would just tell me like, "Bring them. You got to bring them in 10 at a time, bro. You can't bring all these people in at one time, bro. And I'd be making 11, 12 trips." And this is when the rap police was gang unit, so they'd be looking, and then they start asking the people at the club, "Yo, who is this nigga that you're not saying nothing? He keep bringing all these people in and all these gang." And legend of Jim Jones was born.
Yeah, and who was working the door?
Peter be in the front sometime. Mark was the head of security. Bobby Trans used to work,
yep,
too.
Yep, yeah.
He'd be inside of shit, so he had to see me before I got in. Like, he was the last dude to take the tickets, and he just be like, I don't know what they... I'm not telling you nothing. You heard? Like, just go ahead.
Yeah. You know, I'm so glad you brought up Bobby Trends. He's one of my favorite guests that we've ever had up here, and I know he talked about how he used to work the tunnel door.
I used to hand out the comp tickets in the tunnel. Mm. Even before that, I used to have to stand at the door and hand out fucking flyers all
night.
So
all the white girls with big tits got in?
No, actually.
Every single one.
All the fucking scary ass thugs, man. Because they'd come in and be like, "I better get it for free, man. You're going to die." You know what I'm saying? It was crazy. I'm just like, my man, like, I'm working. Like, how do I defend myself without getting fired again?
Right. You gave away your switchblade. Like, yeah.
It was fucking crazy, man. It was like, they were like, yo, that guy over there, just make sure you take care of him because he's the guy that supplies all the guns and the vests for all the, like, the everybody.
Yeah.
New York Police Department.
Yeah.
So he actually died.
Damn.
He had a heart attack or something, so we could talk about him. It's okay.
So you, who was coming through? Dipset?
Oh, so no, Jim Jones.
Yeah.
Came through. There was no Dipset at the time. There was Cam'ron.
Yep.
And Jim was his road manager / hype man.
Yep.
He'd come through with 50 Bloods, everybody dressed in red. Like, there was no hiding it. Like, it was like, no, let's try our best to wear everything red.
When did music go from a hobby to a career for Dipset?
When he first got his deal signed, we were in the game, but we were in the game with little knowledge about what we were doing. We were with some people that had a lot of money and a lot of resources, but had little knowledge of how to execute and use that money and resources for what an album should be on and shit like that. So they ended up losing their deal, and from them losing our deal, we lost our deal and ended up being stuck on a label that really couldn't do nothing for us. So when that happened is when we kind of got discouraged, so kind of knocked us back, and you had to live life, and you know, you got to take chances or whatever it is that we chose to do. And we bounced back by Dame giving us a line, a Rockefeller line, and started with him managing, and then him from managing to him offering Cam a deal.
Well, what was it like for you the first time you met Jay?
I never really met Jay. It's kind of like popped up. Mm-hmm. They heard Cam sign and I was always there. Me and Jay built that rapport about me coming to the studio and eventually him talking to me like, "Yo, you know this is my spot." Like, "Yeah, I know this is your spot, bro." Like,
What you trying to say? Like, nah, bro, you get, you know, there's a certain way niggas pay homage or a certain way gangsters salute each other, especially when you walk in somebody else's spot. And it's like, all right, you got it. You absolutely right, blood. I won't let that happen no more. I apologize for that. And that's how we got on a talking basis and shit like that. And that's it. But, you know, I guess they could tell that I was the wild one out of the bunch and shit like that. And for my demeanor and the way I used to come in, and they used to play guts. I'd get in the game, gamble my thousands of dollars with them. It was a real good experience, man.
When was the first time you met Biggs?
I've known Biggs for years. And
you went to high school with hip hop.
Yeah, I went to high school with hop. He was like a year before me or 2 years before me. I ended up getting kicked out of Catholic school in my senior year. Ended up in Richmond. That's where Hop and them was going to school at already. Biggs just like a little legend on the east side already for having work and having money and shit like that.
For anyone just wondering, Jim has a green apple. So how well did you know Un when you guys first signed that deal? And who was advising you guys?
Yeah, like, did you guys have lawyers? Did you guys have...
We didn't have a lawyer. We didn't have no advisors. We were our own advisors. We're still our own advisors.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have no older people that gave us no advice. We learned by making mistakes.
But what about Mace? Did his success show you how to do business in the right way or in the wrong way?
Well, Mace gave him Cam the helping hand against Sam, but we wanted to take our own role. We didn't, you know, want to follow after the path of Mace.
So what was the conversation with Dame like when you decided that you couldn't be at Epic anymore?
Conversation was cool. I think Dame was a businessman at that time. He was hot. He knew what Cam was worth. It made sense.
Did you think it was realistic that you guys would be able to get out of that Epic situation and go somewhere else? Or was it like maybe you'll have to stay and abide by that contract and have to put another album out with them?
We did put an album out there, and then after we put that album out, when we looked to get off the label.
So I remember exactly where I was. I remember the gas station that I was sitting at in my car when I was listening to you guys go on Angie's show to announce that you were going to sign with Rockefeller, and to a Rockefeller fan, that meant everything to me. But what did it mean to you guys to join a label of that stature at that time?
It meant a second opportunity at life in this game. Where gave us all our energy back. Felt like they put our capes back on, turned us back into superheroes. That's how I felt.
Did you see it as a pathway for Juelz? Did you see it as a pathway for you?
Yeah, it was a major move. I see it as a pathway for the whole movement. Everything that we've been trying to do and getting with some people that understood what the movement was and didn't try to stifle us and let our young energy be seen, and you know what I mean? And not trying to make us live through their success but attain our own success by the shit we like to do.
So I need you to talk more about one of my favorite things from the Rockefeller show we did, which was finding out that you were engineering sessions for Cam and everything.
Yeah, I don't have an engineer. Long time ago, Cam used to have an engineer named Carlisle and shit like that. And Carlisle engineered all our sessions when we were younger. And shit, I used to always ask questions. I was always inquisitive. And I was good with computers. I had to do this whole career training organization shit when I graduated, trying to get a job. So I kind of knew the gist of computers, and I used to always ask Carlisle questions. And then when Pro Tools were hitting, laptops and shit like that first came out, it would see the same rig as it would be in the studio. And I started to ask Carlisle, there's no way that we could possibly have a portable studio? And Carlisle was, yeah, the rock and roll artists do it all the time. It's called an inbox. Keep in mind, it's like 2000.
Mm-hmm.
Ain't nobody know what an inbox was. I was the absolute first artist with an inbox.
Crazy.
Probably the one that fucked up the studio game. I'm probably the one that kind of gave the key out to the whole industry, because that's after I did that 5 years later, and studios were shutting down and shit like that, and I seen Rockefeller take away their whole studio budgets from all the artists and give all of them inboxes and laptops and whole speaker setups and tell them to record like that. And
after Rockefeller Office started being Beanie and them in there recording in different offices, like recording real album tracks inside the office off the M-Box. Like, it was just crazy. So now you, even this setup here.
Yeah.
I'm probably half of the reason why this is going on and shit like that. Hmm. Or, and then I remember when I first did a All-Star game in LA, and I bring DMX upstairs, like Busta upstairs. I just had so many people in amazement, like, yo, bro, what the fuck are you doing? Fuck you mean you recording in this and all of that? And then when Carlisle told me what to get, he's like, get that, come back, and I'll show you how to use it. Mm. I got all the pieces from Guitar Center. Came back, and every day I would learn something new and shit like that. And then went from me learning how to do that to me just telling Cam, you might as well just let me record your sessions, because every session came with an assistant, and the assistant had to know everything, all the boards and all that shit. So it was kind of simple. I just had to sit behind a computer and record and all that type of shit, and use the assistant for all the shit I didn't know, like plugins and all that type of shit. It's rather genius, you know?
Yeah. We had Arsonist from the Heatmakers up here, and he talked about working with you guys on Diplomatic Immunity Volume 1. They take nine of your tracks.
11 in total when it's all said and done, but 9 off of that CD.
Well, I mean, that had to be mind-blowing.
The crazy thing is after when we were doing the track list, is Jim is doing the tracks. He's like, yo, who produced I'm Ready? He was like, yo, Heatmakers. He's like, yo, who produced More Than Music? He's like, Heatmakers. He's like, who produced Santana the Great? He's like, Heatmakers. He was like, yo, goddamn, these people make more money off this album than me. So, yeah, that's when he figured it out.
Austin has been around for a long time. They start making them beats, kind of put a different sound on what we were doing and shit like that. You know, it felt at home. It just meshed and shit like that.
Weren't you guys like the tour guides for a lot of Southern artists when they would come to New York? Like, who are some of the guys that you showed around town?
A lot of people, man. T.I., Game, Lil Flip. So many. It was just a few, but just period, just a lot. So many artists coming to town that we took out around. Cash Money and them, Baby Wayne and them. Oh, man. A lot of gangsters, too, we took around the town. A lot of gangsters from other states that we took around New York and shit like that. Let them feel our town and see how we living and shit like that. We mix it up a lot of hustlers. Come to the town, we take them to go shopping, take them to the clubs and shit like that. They bust up thousands of dollars on bottles and shit like that. That's when, you know, New York was at its highest moment and shit like that. And there were a plethora of clubs for us to go to and have a ball at.
Was Master P one of those people? When did you first meet him?
Master P, we met him the day of the, you met him when he did the track. He did the track for us. I believe we was in L.A. I would like to say we was in L.A. when he did the track, and then Cam got him to do the video. And he came to Harlem. You know? Me and Cam was wasting his time. Remember when we was shooting the video, and he told us some fly shit. Like, y'all niggas got 40 minutes. I'm worth 23 million, boy. Y'all got me out here in the middle of Harlem. Me and Cam just bust out laughing. Like, oh, shit.
Hey guys, we just wanted to interrupt for a second to remind you that this episode is sponsored by our friends over at Martell Cognac.
Nobody likes hearing straight ad copy.
Right.
Like, ever.
Right.
But I think that we figured out a way to make it more palatable.
I agree.
Not only is Wale a spokesman for Martell, but so is Quavo. Martell is bringing VS Cognac to a new level with the introduction of Martell VS Single Distillery, a cognac of exceptional richness,
mama,
and vivid fruit aromas.
Oh!
Martell VS Single Distillery reveals pleasant notes of plum,
hey,
apricot,
what,
and candied lemon,
yep,
and rich fruity flavors on the palate.
As a pioneer in the spirits world, Martell continues its legacy with Martell Blue Swift.
Bow, bow, rah, rah.
The first ever VS SOP cognac finished in Kentucky bourbon barrel.
Chill.
Martell Blue Swift combines Martell's signature style,
trap,
of delicate fruit and plum notes,
oh,
now complemented by the subtle sweetness of vanilla and toasted oak,
yep,
from the bourbon casks.
We're talking gourmet aromas and caramelized pears with subtle hints of vanilla and coconut,
ooh,
and ginger and candace fruits and plums.
Gonna buy the whole rack, gonna buy the whole rack, gonna buy the whole rack, gonna buy.
With a smooth, long-lasting oak finish.
We done.
Shout outs to our friends over at Martell Cognac. Over 300 years of great tradition from the oldest of the four great cognac houses, Martell Cognac.
What you been sipping on?
Martell Cognac. Cognac.
And now back to our interview with Jim Jones.
Another clip from Arsonist that we really liked was when he talked about Dipset's effect on the South. Recently, Joe Budden on Everyday Struggle said that he gives credit to Dipset for enabling the South to sort of like grow beyond just the South.
Of course. What I'm saying now is going to seem blasphemous, but understand what I'm saying and really think about it. We help create trap music. Now, when I say that, think about the records that I made and think about the bounce. Think about Postman. Take out the kicks and snares on Postman. It's a trap song. Wait a minute, Mr. I mean, not even snares. Just take out the kicks and put 808s. Mm. Wait a minute, Mr. It's a trap song. The bounce was a trap song. A lot of the Dipset records were, I made a lot of my beats slower. But I used crazy hi-hats to make them feel like they were moving faster than what they were. So that's what's going on now. The same crazy hi-hats. Because I remember Timbaland used to have his hi-hats a certain way. And I'm like, nah, I don't want to do it like that. That's too fast. So I'll put my shit on like a 16th and a third for all the producers. They would know what that means. But it's like, it's a different swing. You know what I mean? And it gave a different type of bounce. And producers do it to this day. They switch it up, but they do that. They, you know, like if you listen to the hi-hats, a lot of that is reminiscent of the stuff that I did in 2000. So it's not far-fetched to say that Dipset helped enable us out.
Cam went to college in Dallas. So when he would come back from college all the time and shit like that, he just would tell us about so much different music from the South and all that type of shit. Like, no, I'm telling you, it was a different sound, but it'd be going crazy out there. And keep in mind, we teenagers and shit like that. So that kind of stuck with us. And as he started getting his deal, the South, we was just fans of it at that point. And Twista from Chicago, like it's just a whole different sound of music we always was fans of and shit like that. And we knew to kind of navigate around the country, the best thing we'd do is get to these places and kind of soak it all up and put our own twist in it, and you know what I mean, build rapport with all these artists in the South and shit like that, and make it a smooth transition and shit for us to move back and forth through the country and make music and all that type of shit. And then our sound kind of like fused our New York sound with a down South type of sound, and now you can play Dipset records inside the club with down South records, and it just, you know,
yeah,
it worked. I wouldn't say we premeditated that, but it was part of it. Part of a sketchy plan, you know.
When did you move to Jersey?
We moved to Jersey. Camp signed his deal in 97-98. I stayed in Harlem until my apartment got raided, probably like in, I want to say my apartment got raided in 99, 2000, maybe. Something like that.
Jesus, were you home when it got raided?
Yeah.
What was that like?
What? Scary. Concussion grenades, a lot of smoke.
Jesus.
Big machine guns in your face. So ill. Bunch of police rushing in your apartment, kicking you on the floor.
Were they breaking your shit?
No, they didn't break too much shit. After they got in, my uncle was trying to hold them from getting in, hold the whole door closed with his feet and his hands on the door and shit like that. Like, it was crazy. After they got in, it was just like, my uncle was like, all right. Let me just make this easy for y'all and show you what's going on. My uncle just showed them what the dope was, and they locked both of us up and shit. Mm. Good experience. Yeah, my uncle took the rap dolls. My nigga for life.
I feel like you're using the word good wrong.
Yeah, no kidding.
You said it was a good experience.
Yeah, where we from, it definitely is a good experience. Yeah, it's a real scared straight. When you go through moments like that and knowing that your freedom could be taken from you, or an F could be put on your report card, which is a felony, might prohibit you from doing something great in life and shit like that, and you got somebody great like your uncle take the rap for you, because you know how great you probably could be.
Did you see it for yourself?
Yeah, I get a glimpse of it every now and then.
How great you could be? But you believed in it?
Yeah, I always believed in what I could do. I never knew what I was going to do. But I always knew that it'd be something, and I'd be in front of a lot of people.
Certainly, you were dope behind the lens, and we know what you were doing in the studio. But when did you decide that Jim Jones was going to be in front of the camera?
I always knew I was an artist, just who I was. Didn't have to rap. I just was a different type of artist. And when I did get a chance to do music and shit like that, I led with my lifestyle as opposed to the music. And my music caught up. As you get used to anything, you get better at it. Like, you shoot 1,000 basketballs every day, you're going to get a jump shot sooner or later. So, you know what I mean? But my lifestyle was a real thing. It was a real movie for people to watch. You know what I mean? And content was everything for Dipset back in the days. We gave them a different look on the industry. Nobody was kind of capitalizing on that type of content.
Yo, Dipset were the content kings.
At the height of banging just started in New York City, and people only know him for being in the West Coast or Chicago, and you got New York Bloods and nobody understanding what's going on. And you got this young kid from Harlem. Just brazy as fuck.
Who gave you your first deal?
My first deal was it was Koch.
Yeah, Alan Grunblatt.
Alan Grunblatt gave me my first deal.
But you self-funded it, right?
Well, I self-funded it until I got my first deal. I kind of did the music. I was already doing the music before my sign to Allen and shit like that. And by the time I got to Allen, I already had certified gangsters on the radio and all that type of shit. I probably spent the upwards of about $50,000 out of my pocket every night in the Sony studio, cashing them out, $800, $900 a day.
Did you shoot that video, or was that under Koch?
I got the bunch from Koch, and then I flew to L.A. Got with some good bloods that I know out there. Shouts to my nigga Wacko. Wacko, what's up, gangster? Booyah Tribe. Hey, let me do what I need to do out there as far as showcases how real we are as being bloods in New York, and let them know it's all the same struggle, man. Ain't no different than the deaths.
Do you think you surprised people with certified gangsters?
Yeah. I gave New York a new sound. I gave West Coast a nostalgic sound. It worked at that time. I mean, it's some new cultures matched. I mean, I went to LA, did the video. The video matched. Mm-hmm. It was dope. You know what I mean? Game's first time being seen on any type of television was in Certified Gangsta, so it was a monumental video.
But you did that solo deal with Koch, and obviously that was after you guys left Rockefeller. Was there ever a thought while you were at Rockefeller that you'd put out a Jim Jones album over there?
We was all Rockefeller when I did the deal at Koch.
Oh, really?
After I did the deal at Koch while Cameron did the deals at Rockefeller, because Rockefeller didn't want to give me a deal, so me and Cam.
So it was on the table. It was an idea.
Yeah, I wanted $1 million. Dame didn't want to give me $1 million.
Is it too late? When 50 Cent was calling Koch a graveyard, did you give a shit?
Nah. Shit, graveyard was paying me millions of dollars. Fuck that. I'm the gravekeeper then. It's a hell of a graveyard.
Yeah.
So we were just down at South by Southwest, and Mass Appeal had a huge show.
Big show.
That Just Blaze was DJing, and he put on Ballin'. You know, we're talking 2018, the song is still going off, 4,000 people in the audience, and it's in Austin, Texas, and they're all doing the Ballin' motion.
And it was amazing.
It was amazing.
Did you see that coming when you wrote the song?
Yeah, did you see the longevity? Do you think that it surprised people?
That surprises me to this day. It made me cringe and surprises me at the same time. I got a love-hate relationship with that song at this point, but, you know, it's definitely a historical song. I called it a Michael Jackson hit. That shit hit forever. It ain't going nowhere no time soon. And, you know, it's theme music. It's like a couple of other records that come on, and you're going to know them, whether they're from the 60s, 70s, 80s, or 90s. Just another one to add to the bunch.
What else do you feel is forever?
I really mean it.
Dipset Anthem.
I really mean it. It's forever. There's a few records that's forever and shit like that.
Oh, Hey Ma.
Old Boy is forever.
Yep. Hey Ma.
Dipset Anthem is forever. Hey Ma is forever. We got a few.
What does the phrase powerful music mean to you?
Powerful music. Music that does something to you. A lot of people make good music, but not a lot of people make powerful music. Tupac make powerful music.
But was that like a phrase that you guys were saying around that time, or did you just use that for the song?
Well, that was just a phrase that was part of a slogan. We make powerful music. Like, that's a true story. We make music that hit the soul. Music that make you want to do some shit. You know what I mean?
When you were talking on Come Home With Me, did you have that mapped out in your head, or was that like, put me in the booth and let me go?
I just pretty much put me in the booth and let me go. After I sit down and think about it, I don't really use no pens. I got a good brain. They say the shit that I do is using both the sides of my brains at the same time. That's kind of not normal and shit like that. So I guess I'm gifted.
You put Ballin' out, it goes crazy. That has to open up your touring as a solo artist. What was your biggest market for you outside of New York City?
When Ballin' was out, it didn't even matter. Yeah. It didn't matter where I went. That shit was on fucking fire.
Out of the country, too?
Out of wherever, it didn't matter. That shit was on fucking fire. That shit just was ballin'.
Mm.
You dig? Out of the country, they didn't know nothing. I could do an hour worth of songs, and as soon as Ballin' come on... They with it. They happy. Yeah. That's what we was waiting for this whole time.
So. Were you a Giants fan?
Yeah.
Or did you just become a Giants fan because, like, they used the song?
Oh, some bandwagon Jets
like
fan.
86 when they won the Super Bowl mm-hmm. with JoJo Morrison and shit like that.
Hot 97, Summer Jam, every year.
Every year.
Dipset comes on stage and it would rain.
Fact.
So, what's up with that?
Yeah.
I don't know. Every year we would buy bigger ring so it could shine inside that spotlight, though, in the rain. They didn't care about the rain. We cared about shining. So every year we made sure we brought new cars and new diamonds just to go to Summer Jam.
Follow up, what's the most amount of people you've had on stage?
Us, Dipset? Oh, man, I couldn't even tell you. That's fucking ridiculous sometimes, man. I don't even know how them people get on the stage half the time, man.
See, but now you roll with a small crew.
Yeah, I cool out now. I'm a little bit older, man. I don't think nobody want to see me doing that. I think I proved myself. I don't think nobody want to get in my way for any type of reason.
Can you talk for a second about your influence on style right now?
It's a big influence.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of birthed the rock star style, whole chain gang style. I made everybody wear slimmer clothes, all the flamboyant shirts and all the shit that niggas is wearing. I kind of put that in effect. I mean, they doing it way slimmer than I was doing, almost to... Some of them doing it almost to a feminine point, but I guess that's what they doing. That's not what I'm doing, but, you know. I mean, I'm just a stylist, too. Like I said, since high school, I've been doing shit that people have been copying and shit like that, whatever. Making my own denim suits or putting my own twist on somebody else's clothes. And, you know, it's infectious and shit like that. If you be around me and shit like that, you learn how to put a different swag on your dress and shit like that. Like, you just pick it up, you know what I mean? Like, same thing I bring to the game. Like, you know, I dress different. I dress in my own way. I'm from Harlem. You get dressing lessons when you come outside every day. You get fresh lessons, nigga. You come outside and you ain't on top of your fresh, niggas gonna heat you up. They're gonna make jokes about you. Bitches gonna laugh at you. So, one thing that we made sure we learned how to do is stay fly in Harlem, man. You know, that comes with the edge.
Whose idea was Dipset Christmas?
That was my idea. I just wanted to get another check out of that. Trying to figure out how I can get another half a million out of him.
December's coming up.
Fucking Thanksgiving. Like, yo, by the way, I'm going to do a Dipset Christmas. Let me get this check real quick.
I still can't believe it happened.
It ended up being very dope album. My favorite album to make with Stax. Stax was very instrumental on doing the whole Dipset Christmas. He was with it. Like, yo, geez, this shit is dope, geez. You don't even know. This is going to go in the hood, geez. It's my nigga, Stax, man. Yeah, that was really his album right there. I should have put him as executive producer on that because he really filled in the blanks on that album.
What's your favorite song off of it?
I don't know. I don't really like the verses I was on. I just like all the Stax verses that was on that shit. There's a few of them on there. You know, I'm good. I'm bad with music, especially my own music. After I record in the studio 9 times out of 10, I forget it. I don't know half the records on half of my albums.
Really? So songs come up that you did a feature on, and you're like, oh, right.
I don't even know that shit at all.
Oh, you know what? We first met you at the video set for
Youngberg
remix
with Rich Boy. Yeah.
Mm. That was an odd group.
Just three friends hanging out.
Odd group.
Odd group of gentlemen for that remix. Yeah. Like to know ya.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, that was good. That was a good one.
And then not long after, we came to visit you at Warner Music Group, where you were an A&R at the time. We would stop A&R by your office. Direct. What do you remember about that time?
I direct shit.
Yo, what did you do with some of those budgets?
Well, I had fun with some of them budgets, man. It made sense. They gave me a credit card, gave me an office, gave me some responsibilities, shitload of money above my head to spend, as long as I spend it right and I'm just justifiable. And I know how to do one thing I know how to do is justify some shit.
Yo, who can do more damage on a corporate card, you or Mike Kaiser?
Oh, no, I don't even know. I wouldn't even put my bro out there like that. I don't even know what Berg would be doing. You heard? This shit must be out there if you're asking me, though. This shit must be legend.
Wait, didn't you have a fish tank in your office?
Yeah.
I had a fish tank in my
on
office.
On a wall, yeah.
Me? My office?
Yeah.
No, maybe.
Yeah, it was definitely there.
I can't remember. Did Yandy put a fish tank in there?
Maybe.
Yeah, Yandy, if you're listening, leave a comment.
Let us know.
You know, we need to figure this out.
I was high the whole shit in there.
Well, who were some of the artists that you were able to work with over there?
Who the fuck did I work with? It was one artist that they had that Leo had gave me, that Leo had liked. I forgot his name. But he loved his artist. He ended up giving me like $1 million budget to take him to Miami. And
damn.
Executive producer shit and get some records on. The kid ended up having like one record. You know, you go one of these talent shows, and I guess that one record must have wooed Leo signed him on the spot. And the nigga ended up being garbage, man.
Damn. You and Puff got close back then, didn't you?
Yeah, I know Puff for a minute, back and forth. That's my nigga. It's big bro.
You had a song with Puff and Paul Wall.
And Jaja.
Oh, What You Been Sipping On. And
I had a few songs with Diddy. Diddy been on a couple of records that
yeah.
I did.
Yeah, great record.
Yeah, What You Been Sipping On.
Wait, really important question. Diddy. How many people are on Dipset?
How many people are on this whole army of us? I mean, there's a few artists, but it's more of an army than anything.
Name them.
No, but how did the Cat Williams thing happen?
Killer being a businessman and trying to find out different angles that could make Diplomats bigger, and I thought that was genius. Cat Williams was on fire at the time. Like, shoot, it was Cat Williams.
Literally.
And he was rubbing the Diplomats hard, so it was dope.
And Dipski was your idea?
Yeah. Just trying to get into the X Games. Like, I'm still a fan of the X Games and the BMXs and all that type of shit.
What's some business that we don't know about that Diplomats were involved in that you thought could have been the next big thing?
I mean, legally.
We were trying to do cologne. When we did the old boy, we were trying to do the old boy cologne, but we couldn't find the right cologne manufacturer and shit like that.
Did you go through the testing?
Yeah, were
smells?
You testing out smells?
Yeah, but Dame had hooked us up with this bullshit nigga that made cologne. Bullshit nigga. Ended up fucking up our whole gaffle, so we just left it at that.
So, talking about style, you knew ASAP Ferg very early.
Yeah, I know Ferg from baby.
Actually, let's play a clip of Ferg up here talking about his belt business.
One meeting we had, me, Jim Jones, and B.B. Simon was this belt guy. He had the big factory in L.A. where he, like, it was Swarovski crystals, like, where they just make all these belts and stuff. So he was like, B.B. Simon wanted to do a belt with Jim Jones because he seen Jim Jones was doing wearing a lot of his belts.
Skulls.
So what Jim Jones was going to do, he was going to bring me in to design the belts.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? And, like, so we it was like a...
You were ghostwriting the belts.
The belts, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, we had another meeting at this event that Stan Lee and Neo and Joe Jackson had. And I met B.B. Simon there, but Jim Jones didn't show up.
Right.
So I'm like, damn, Jim is fucking it up. You know, because I'm like, damn, this dude is ready to go. Like, I'm like, man, this is it. Like, yeah. I'm going to L.A. I'm about to make these belts. But he never showed up, and Simon didn't really want to do business with me if it wasn't with Jim, because Jim is the face. So, like, it kind of fell apart and, you know, whatever. But I just thank Jim for even... You know, even think about me to be in that situation. Yeah,
he was making belts.
Did you see it for him?
For what, rapping?
Yeah, rapping or style or just whatever.
He always wanted to be in fashion. He would always come by the studio, show me his little t-shirts he made, or show me his belt. I got one of his belts still in my house. It was like a red bottom belt. The back of the belt was red and the front was camouflage and shit like that. Ferg was mad at me. I ain't give him $700 back then to go get some supplies and make some more belts and shit like that. He still got a little grudge about it.
Did you know his father?
It's my nigga, though. Yeah, I know his father. Father's from Harlem.
Mm-hmm.
Older dude, 45th. You know, yeah. Hustling tight, get in between things. Not too aggressive, more about getting money. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
He was on that side of the fence of Harlem.
What'd you think when you saw the Calvin Klein billboards with the whole ASAP mob on there?
That's dope. That was very fly. Very fly. That was very cultural appropriate, I think. Or,
yeah.
You had a chance to sign some other kids. We know that J. Cole and his team came to you at one point.
J. Cole didn't have a team when they came to me. He didn't have a team. It was just J. Cole rapping. A little light-skinned kid coming to the studio every day rapping like Drake. And at that point, it was Drake. I didn't know, niggas didn't know what to do with no Drake. Drake was just like a phenomenon at that point. And shit, can't have two of them right now. As you see, it took him a few years after that to kind of find his place and what he wanted to do. You know what I mean? He ain't rapping like Drake no more, but when he was in my studio, he was.
Actually, Eric and I were both there when you did your Broadway show. Mm-hmm. Shouts to Sophie Ash.
How you like it?
I liked it. I was sitting next to Angela Yee. We had a great time.
Yo, you paid great tribute to Stax that night.
What was your process in putting it together?
Being creative. It was really supposed to be a listening session. So, you know, I signed to Sony. I know I had a little bit of a budget for marketing and promotion. I was like, man, I want to do something totally different for my listening session. I want to act at every song like I was in a play. You know, I was just going to do some simple shit. And then it's like, you know, Yandy found a director. You know, Dame at that time, I had acquired Dame to help me do a lot of shit. And then turned into a big production and ended up being like 22 people in a musical. And I was practicing every night for 4 or 5 hours. And every day and for the last 2 weeks for 8 hours a day. And just, you know, we was in there when Obama got elected.
Really?
The night Obama got elected, we was in the midst of rehearsal. And Brooke Shields was in there, I believe. And
what was she doing there?
Another actor. She was checking out my production. One of Dame friends, he was calling a lot of people over this to see.
Wow.
The musical that we was doing and bringing them through practice and, you know, people giving us pointers and shit like that.
Were you nervous?
Nah, not really. It's cool. Once I got some, I got some.
Do you get nervous ever?
Yeah, a lot. All the time. It's cool. Never being nervous is a great thing. It's part of life.
So often over the past 5 or 6 years, there would be a big announcement from Funkmaster Flex or whoever the Dipset was about to do a reunion, and we'd get all excited and mark the date in the calendar, and then it wouldn't happen.
Nope.
And then we'd get excited again, and it wouldn't happen again. And finally, Spotify put together a show last year, and the whole Dipset showed up and killed. I mean, apparently.
Yeah, we weren't.
Because we didn't get in. We were stuck outside with a million other people in the street, and the cops weren't happy.
No, I mean, but what we thought that it had been canceled because we saw Cam and like half of Harlem like walking down the street to a garage and then hashing it out with Spotify people to come back inside.
Yeah, that was a hell of a mess out there. But I mean, it's natural, man. If you ever been to a Dipset concert in New York,
and we have,
that was a great feeling. I wouldn't trade it for the world.
Yeah. What's your favorite Dipset reunion? Because there's been like 30.
I would like to say the BET, when we did the BET Awards. I liked that. That was dope.
You know, I don't know if a lot of people know this, but Joe LaPuma, you guys go way back. You were actually the inspiration for sneaker shopping on Complex.
Oh, man, that's my guy. I mean, I told him a lot about sneaker shopping from a real sneakerhead perspective. I mean, a sneakerhead, not like a sneakerhead, but, you know, a dope boy sneakerhead.
Yeah.
We the reason why there are sneakerheads. They just started being sneakerheads. Dope boys been the sneakerheads. They were the only ones that had the money to buy all the sneakers that dropped every week or all the sneakers that dropped every day. It was the dope boys that had the money for that. And that tradition followed with the rappers who ended up getting rap deals and wanted to be like the dope boys, and they kept it going from the late 80s all the way to now. I mean, in the mid 80s and in the early 80s, sneakers just kind of started getting popping and shit like that. When you had the Pumas with the fat shoelaces, you had the shell toes, but it wasn't that many variations. Cortez started popping a little bit after that, but they was rocking British Walkers and all that type of shit back then, and pinstripe, like, it was just a whole different type of fashion. So as the late 80s came on, when the dope boy hustler niggas from Harlem started getting in, mob style type of niggas and all that, that's when the sneakers started to come in into heavy, and that's when all the really dope boy fashion started to come in heavy and shit like that. And then by the time the 90s came, and the 90 drop, Jordans was in full effect, Nike was super booming, it just was all about Nike after that. Niggas had to have a fresh pair. It wasn't no more British Walkers, none of that shit. It was Timberlands, Beef and Broccoli's, High Top Constructions, 40 Below's, and some Nikes or the Reebok Classics, or the different pair, the soft ones. It was, you know, don't get me to talk about sneakers.
What were some of the sneaker stores you would hit up as a teenager?
Mr. G's was like the main sneaker store we would hit on the east side. Mr. G's started off as a full toy store, then turned half a toy store into half a sneaker store, then turned into a whole sneaker store, and they used to have everything. Everything Mr. G's had, bro. Like, everything. So from like 87 to like through high school, that's 3rd Avenue. Then you had Dave's right next to Mr. G's. Then you had Pegasus on 109th. That was a block there. You had Tom, Dick, and Harry between 105th and 106th and 107th and shit like that. You had sneaker stores on 121st Street. You had Jans that was always popping. That was more for jeans and shit like that. 45th Street, you go upstairs to KP's and all that shit. They had KP Cons, I believe it was called back then. They had sneakers. Then BJ's, they had sneakers up there. There was a lot of sneaker stores in Harlem, man. They had places where they had, always had the old school sneakers on Broadway, like by 33rd, 33rd. That was like 135th, 136th. All over Harlem, there were sneakers that we was trying to get. And we were trying to get a deal, too. You know, you had Dr. J's. We'd go to Dr. J's sometimes to go shop on the table. The table was the $30 sneakers, but they would have all the last year sneakers out on the table. And if you was a fly nigga, you know how to finesse the last year. A pair of old sneakers always looked as good as a pair of new sneakers if they was brand new. If I could bring out a pair of Court Force from last year on you this year, and they brand spanking new, you like, oh, you still, where you get those from? It's just like how it is now, and kids love these retro kicks, and you get a fresh pair of old J's, and niggas go crazy. It was the same back then, like you had a fresh pair of kicks from last season, and niggas ain't got no more, you lit. So, you know.
You met Dr. J, didn't you?
Yeah, I met Dr. J at a commercial, Converse commercial we got to shoot. Cool dude. Dope. Dr. J.
Not to like belabor the point, but you haven't actually filmed a sneaker shopping episode with Joe. Are you going to?
I don't know. If you do, you probably just have to come to G's, to my sneaker store. And we just have some sneaker talk. Dig, it's a little bit different now. I ain't got to go nowhere for sneakers no more. We got our own infrastructure. GBNY. He could meet me there. And we could go to all G sneaker stores. They got like 5 of them. I mean, that's where I get all my sneakers from.
You're wearing a track jacket by Emery Jones for Puma.
Yeah.
What's your relationship with Emery?
It's OG. Shouts to Big M. Big bro. Little bigger bro than me, you know. But that's the bro right there, man. Good guy, got good energy. You know what I mean? Just pressing the issue for the culture at the moment. When it comes to fashion and shit like that, you know, his name ring bells and shit like that. And come to Puma, he's done a lot as far as fusing the culture with Puma and giving them some dope artists up there. So, you know, shout out to Big M.
How many times in your life have you thrown up the rock?
I haven't.
They didn't make you do it when you signed into Rock Nation?
I thought it, yeah.
They didn't make me do anything. Shook Juan's hand. Shouts to OG Wong, man. Shouts to everybody over at Rock Nation, man. They got a hell of a staff, man. A hell of an infrastructure over there, man. You know, and obviously they can see the bigger picture, and you know, they're businessmen over there, so it works, man. And they're helping me out with this Wasted Talent project there. So should be a lot of fun.
Wasted Talent comes out on
Friday, April 13th.
And then what? You going to do any spot dates around?
I'm going to do a little promo tour. I got a little movie that I'm shooting for the video. Like 20-minute mini movie. Plan on doing a screening for that.
You going to be behind the lens?
Yeah. Both behind and in front. Dope-ass concept. When people see it, they're going to be like, that was dope. Because it's a bit of a... Like, I would say the movie is built around the movie. I'm going to just tell y'all that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is there a chance that you do another Broadway show?
Yes, I would love to. I just got to get could get it together. That's not something. It's not the easiest thing we can do. You know what I mean? Like,
no, listen, we got the financing.
Oh shit,
we're good.
Let's do it. Let's do it.
I know Brooke Shields.
No, but that's something. I love doing that. Doing that play. That was one of the funner things that I've done in my career.
Yeah.
Was that play? I really got a great feeling when I did that play. You know when you do something good and you can feel it. And that's what that play did for me. It broke a lot of barriers, too, because I did something that I know nobody in this game has done as yet, and I don't think nobody has the charisma to pull it off. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of things that you've done that a lot of people don't have the charisma or talents to pull off. I think, you know, you're multifaceted. Do you ever sit back and think that, like, you're very unique in this business?
Yeah, I always think about that. I mean, I'm very unique in life. I just, you know, it's just hard when you... It's harder to sell yourself, and yeah. It's better to have other people sell you.
We get it.
Well, weren't you also one of the first people to, in hip-hop to do reality TV?
Yeah, I kind of...
Yo.
Or were you the first?
I'll say it.
That lane.
I'll say it. Mona stole your idea.
Yeah, she did. It was cool. She kind of was a little bit smarter than me at that, you know. But shit happens for a reason. Life is life, man. You know, I get all mine's back.
Mm.
You did, but reality TV, I put that on the map for a lot of people. You know what I mean? As I watched it today, it makes me laugh.
But you know what's interesting about the way you did it is that, like, there's a lot of people who are, like, done and retired and doing it now. It gives them, like, a second wave. Like, you were right in the middle of your career.
Yeah, I mean, I always look for different opportunities to, you know, advance and doing new shit. And that's one I should have capitalized off of, but I still got time to capitalize off of as content and new production and new shows or something that's going on every day. You know, when it comes to us being on TV, we kind of got a knack for doing that shit as we got the boot camp show that's on right now, and I think the only reason people watch it is to see us anyway, so, you know, we'll be all right.
So you've done a lot of things in terms of fashion, in terms of music, in terms of movies, in terms of music videos, in terms of engineering.
I taught a school curriculum, high school curriculum for like 4 years.
Right, right.
Music biz 101. Shouts to all my kids who've taken my class and graduated from my class.
Was it just to say, look out for the snakes?
What?
Music business 101?
Yeah.
Oh, no, that was, it's a high school curriculum to take a whole high school classroom and break it down into a fully functioning record label, and I show them how to market and promote an artist and a single from beginning to the end and what it takes and entails, and everybody takes their responsibility of the department, and then I bring in somebody from somebody new from each of the department, explain to kids what their job responsibilities are, and then you know, they get it, I give them a little test at the end.
And then when do you buy all the bottles for T.I.?
Oh, shit.
When does that fit in?
Shit, that's my favorite part of the music business.
Yeah.
I need to get back there again.
Have you ever thought about taking another job in a building?
Yeah. I mean, shit, why not? We'll see. I'm worth a lot. You dig?
Started $1 million.
You know, I think it'll work.
Wait, when you did work at WMG, did they give you like a pass? Did you to like show to security every day? Like,
yeah, have security pass, have everything. Oh. Full 1K benefits,
what?
Everything.
Check in with HR and all that?
The full
getting
shit.
Lunch everything. Down the street at like the man. Corner cafe?
I was the director of the A&R for Warner Music Group. My shit was big.
Who were some of your fellow A&R? Nigel Talley?
Nigel wasn't there at the
no?
time.
Who else was working with you?
I don't know.
A&R was.
I don't give a fuck about that. I don't care about none of that, bro. I don't care who's working with me.
Yo, what's the most bizarre check you ever got?
The most bizarre check I ever got. I don't want to talk about it.
But you got some.
I got a few checks for... I got a few multi-million dollar checks that I blew all of.
Oh, okay.
You heard?
Did you ever do Flex's car show?
Yeah, a bunch of times.
How'd you do?
We used to tear them shits down. We used to race them shits on like 20 foreign cars, doing $140, $150 down the turnpike every summer.
Like a Nissan Sentra.
Nah, we was burning those up. You ain't
Toyota Corolla.
You ain't want to be involved with that if that's what you're rolling.
I'm talking GTs, Flying Spurs, Phantoms, Lamborghinis, Range Rovers, 745s, Benz 600s,
that's,
Porsche
that's
drop
a different
tops.
Kind of shoe shopping, you know, well, on those, on I mean, those the, cars.
We're all talking about foreign cars here.
Yeah.
Mitsubishi Galant.
That's a fact. That's definitely a foreign joint right there.
Talk about Harlem now. Like, what does Harlem mean to you now up here? Like, it's not the same place that you moved out of back in 99.
Nah, Harlem is gentrified. There's big gentrification going on up there, which is dope, man. You know, Harlem has always been not the most presentable place. I mean, not the most prettiest landscape that you wanted to walk through when we was coming up. It was just our home, so we found the beauty in it and shit like that. So to see all these dope buildings going up and they changing the landscape and it looks a little bit better and shit like that, I like it. You know what I mean? I just hope they keep it true to the people that grew up there and don't start to kick us out like they've done in all these other urban communities around the country, like in Chicago when they tore down Cabrini Greens and they kicked them all out to the suburbs and shit like that. Like, when Harlem people need to be in Harlem, you know, all these new jobs and businesses they create. And we can work. Everybody doesn't have a felony. There's a few people in Harlem that could get a job, you know what I mean? Like, so that's my thing. Hopefully they provide some jobs for the people that did come up there, for the people you're trying to kick out of their apartments they grew up in all of their life to make you some money. Why don't you give them a job at the same time, man? Help us live too.
Did you spend time in Central Park or, you know,
Central Park pool? Every summer when we was younger, night pool, jumping over the fence, or they cut a hole in the fence and you going in there at nighttime when it was too hot. Yeah, that's what we did. Central Park pool, Jefferson pool, Mount Morris pool, Uptown, what the fuck, Riverton pool, I believe it is. We used to go to all of the pools, man. It's go crazy. Pools was dangerous, though. Very dangerous for women and shit like that. Like, I seen a lot of girls get violated when we were younger. When we were younger, it was all fun and games and shit like that. Looking back now, if that was my daughter that had to go through that up shit. When I catch a body. But that's coming up in the ghetto. You heard? They justify everything.
Oh, wait, we didn't talk about, where did you get mixtapes?
Where did we get mixtapes? Harlem Music Hut, probably we all spend by there, go get the mixtapes from Harlem Music Hut. But there's a lot of places in Harlem you get mixtapes. My man Luke Abrazi had the whole CD circuit on Smash on 145th Street. We ain't had to go nowhere after a while. Luke had everything. The whole world used to come to 145th Street to buy drugs, clothes, and bootleg CDs.
Just everything you need.
What else more could you want?
Well, congratulations on everything, especially Wasted Talent. We can't wait to see the mini movie, which you won't tell us the plot for, but that's fine. We'll wait. And we appreciate you coming through.
Oh, man, thanks for having me, man. It's been a pleasure. You asked me so many fucking questions.
We appreciate you. Thanks, everyone, for listening to this new episode of A Waste Time with It's The Real Jeff. If people want to find out more about us, we are It's The Real. For anybody who thinks that we're the women's talk show, The Real, that's not us.
Not anymore.
We are It's The Real. One word, no apostrophe, no spaces. Jeff, if they're looking to find out more about us, where can they go?
You can always go to itsthereal.com. You'll see our two smiling mugs on there. Not five women from the women's talk show, The Real.
Isn't that crazy, by the way? Like, you to email us on our website, you have to go through, like, a bunch of different pages and see a bunch of different pictures, and none of them are Adrian Bailon and Tamar Braxton.
Again, not anymore. We've changed our website. You can always find all of our episodes, old and new, on iTunes. Search for A Waste of Time with It's The Real. Why don't you go subscribe? Why don't you comment? Leave a 5-star review, then come back. Go to soundcloud.com/awasteoftime and do the same thing over there.
Yeah.
Life is short. Spend it wisely. Yeah. You can also go and listen to our music, soundcloud.com/itsthereal, or on Spotify, Apple Music,
Tidal,
Google Play.
Yo, Ain't No Jigga was giving us a tough time because we didn't send the Tidal link. But you know what?
It's on there. It's there. Go to Tidal. Search for Teddy Bear Fresh. Our artist splits are the best on Tidal.
Hey.
So shout out to ASCAP and everybody over there. You can always find us on Twitter at It's The Real, Facebook at It's The Real, Instagram at It's The Real. We are also on Reddit at It's The Real. Been getting a lot of clout coins there.
Yeah.
And we are also on Snapchat, but are not we? Really. No, I mean, like, it's there. Somebody sent me a message the other day, and I was like, eh, this whole thing.
Jeff, this podcast is not going anywhere unless we take the time right now at the end of every episode to shout out those people who we consider real-life friends and hope that they do us the favor of passing on word about this podcast to their friends, the people that they consider family and close to kin. So, Jeff, who do you want to shout out today?
I want to shout out two people that I saw at Bodega Bam's album release party this past Friday night. I want to shout out Kenneth El La Rosa. Ooh. Kenneth El La Rosa. Kenneth El La Rosa. He goes by Gotham Kenny on Instagram.
Well, that was easier.
Yeah. I also want to shout out Beat Boy. That's Beat Boy with an I, who I had a long conversation with as well.
Shout out to them.
So shout out to them. I also want to shout out Gotham Kenny's girlfriend. She was nice.
That's awesome.
And I met a lot of good people over there, and so that was all dope. And shout out to Bodega Bams and Ola for...
Definitely.
Oh, and everybody at Duck Down Records for keeping Spanish Harlem popping right now.
There you go. Jeff, I want to shout out somebody that we ran into at Cardi B's New York celebration for her album, her gold album. Mm-hmm. First of all, shout out to all of our friends who worked on that project, Marsha, Ashley, everybody behind the scenes. An amazing job over there at Atlantic Records. I want to shout out, Jeff, somebody that people thought maybe there was a little friction with. Maybe there was a little tense relationship with.
Oh, I mean, that's my fault.
Somebody who maybe there were some shots thrown back and forth a few months ago, and I want to tell everybody here that when we ran into Nori, our friend Noriega,
he was so clear
from the Drink Champs podcast
that there was no beef.
There's no beef.
There's no beef.
We're friends. Yeah. We're looking forward to seeing him at the Roots Picnic, where we are all performing on the podcast stage on June 2nd. Go get your ticket right now at rootspicnic.com. But shout out to Nori, a great dude who
we've known for
forever. Came over, big hugs, lots of laughs. He did, you know, shout out our friend standing next to us, Peter, who looks like John Mayer.
And he asked if he was John Mayer.
But you know what? Not John Mayer. In any event, as always, guys, not for real, for real.
Sure, sure.
See you guys next week.